owner to facilitate the work of this portfolio committee. Minister, this is the committee, but I would just want to do introduction so that you know the people that will actually be, you know, the dialogue, doing a dialogue between ourselves and the department. On my left is Brian Manji. Brian Manji is the committee secretary and the current CEO of this committee. And next to him is Peter Daniel, is our content advisor. And then next to Mr. Daniels is Mr. Willem Janssen van Rensburg. All right. It's our researcher. And we also have other people. I think they are not in the room. Oh, yes, at the back. It's our media officer. Yeah, Miss Lombard is our media officer in the room. So that takes care of the staff that supports the committee. I know your officials will be touching base with some of them. And I'm sure at this stage, because you're meeting the members for the first time, it would be a courtesy that just members introduce themselves. I know some of the members have been in this committee before, I think one or two now. So is the face or faces familiar to you? Members, I'm sorry, we have done the quick introduction yesterday, but that was for ourselves. And can we do it, after which I will then ask the minister to introduce her team as well. And I'll start with you, colleagues.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Jerome Marge, a member of this committee.
Good morning, Chair Minister. My name is Kobus Marais, member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Malia Keshayembe, a member of this committee.
Good morning. My name is Alexandra Bieke, a member of this committee.
Good morning, colleagues. My name is Irima Lolokwaza, member of this committee.
How do you switch on this thing? Yeah, morning. My name is Thabo Mutle, member of this committee.
Morning, Chair. My name is Sam Matthias. I'm from the Free State. I'll be taking off from where Honorable Mfongo left off. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So the left wing, it's members of the committee, Minister. Then the right wing, it's yourself and the... Let me tell you, and I'll hand over to you for the introduction.
Morning, Chair. Morning, honourable members. Just to introduce the team, but also to apologise on behalf of the Secretary of Defence, who is not well. He's not well, General. He's not well. And the Ramkwe is appearing on behalf of the department as a state capture commission in the call that was just at Waterproof investigation. And I learned that there was a question whether the CFO would be here of defense. CFO is not here, but people we have here, we have a team from DOD led by General Masondo, Chief of Staff. We will then introduce his team later. And then from DMV, Chairperson, we have Ms. Mafu, who also has Christine here. She will also introduce her again. Then we have the chair, the CEO of AMSCO, together with board members, they're also here. Then the military ombuds, deputy military ombuds, I'm sure you're not aware, Chair, that our military ombuds have just retired, so we're in the process of finding a new one. So the deputy is here. Which other entity have I mentioned? Are they here? I haven't seen them. There's the custom and the Defence Force Service Commission. I don't know what happened last night when they sent a message that they are not invited anymore. Chair. But they were also preparing to come. That is the team which is here with us this morning. And maybe we can then introduce themselves. I'd like to congratulate you, Chair, together with all honorable members who are part of this committee.
General Masango, maybe you can now introduce the team from the board.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. We need to introduce myself and accompanied by Major General Tamatwana and the other members of the team will be joining us later when we present. Mr. Michael Cox.
Professor Mkaza. Behind me, I'm accompanied by our strategic and planning senior manager, Ms. Katie Neonikas. Next to him is our CFO, Mr. Harald Krobler. On the other side, I'll start on my left-hand side, our group executive for corporate compliance, Advocate Sene. Next to him is our group executive acquisition, Mr. Mkwanas. Right at the back is our company secretary, Ms. Mambe Kumar. Thank you, Chair.
We also have the military ombuds, led by the
Chair. Good morning, Chair. Minister and members. I'm Advocate Zeman. I would like to have the military ombuds. I don't have a team today, but the military ombuds.
So I think that takes care of all the questions. Thank you very much. And we apologize from the end. It's an apology.
Yes. Thanks, Chair. There's an apology of Honorable Mudise, who will join us maybe after a month or so. She's on maternity leave. Thank you.
that apology be recorded. Yes, Mr. Mare.
And also apologies from Honorable Walters.
Honorable Walters. Yeah, he is an alternate.
You see, he's an alternate.
He's an alternate. Okay. And okay, sure, that takes care of the thing. I'm sure there will be apologies from the side of the department, Minister. Doing apologies now.
Yes, as I said earlier on, Chairperson, and is not here. The CFO is also not here. We came out with the statement very late last night, and I know that he has engagement yesterday, which we did not honor, so we're supposed to honor them this morning. Who is not here?
I understand the Deputy Minister was also going to join us.
The Deputy Minister is supposed to join us now on acting calling.
Oh, sure. Okay. So probably on his way. Okay. So that
takes care. He was confused and went into there are two cabinet committees. So
okay. Thank you. That takes care of all the preliminaries. This being the first meeting of the committee, and with the majority of members being new, Minister, so we expect presentation to be a bit detailed, but mindful of the time. Mindful of time, and all the abbreviations and all these things being would expect that the unscrambled again because you are new. So when you get to it, you remember my caution that would want a fuller name or a title, whatever it is, when you do the presentation. Minister, the first item on the agenda is the briefing by the Department of Military Veterans. And I'm sure at the stage I may ask you to do an introductory remarks and then indicate, I'm sure you have done, indicated who will then launch into the presentation. And I'd like you to offer that.
Which I need to say is that we are fully cognizant of the fact that this is the sixth administration, and therefore the APPs which will be presenting today are APPs from 2018-19. Which were APPs which were developed for the purpose of the peace administration. Chair and whip of the portfolio committee, official bank of the intervention. Ladies and gentlemen, no, General, you don't know I'm going to have to wait. He was sick here. This girl was supposed to say something, and now I'm reading from the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, just to say that, firstly, we welcome the opportunity to present our APP to the community. And hopefully the team will be able to go into details about the APPs. Not only the APPs, we had also prepared that it would be preferable that they should also take you through the structure of the department itself so that you can be fully conversant with what we are doing and how we are doing and how we are structured. To say that it takes knowledge during the chair. But I will be okay nonetheless. Anyway. Now, November 2018. And last week, the department also has a set plan. This set plan really talks to issues for 2019-2020. And when we looked at some of the key performance areas, really, even the APPs which we have developed for ourselves, there won't be a significant change between what we'll be doing for 2019-20 from what we have set ourselves for 2018-2019. Now, obviously, you will receive this presentation from DDG Marco, and I'm sure you will have questions which you will raise with regards to how we roll out our benefits in the Department of Military Veterans. And together with the team, I will be ready to take those questions. And then at the point when the DOD will be presenting, I will then give introductory remarks. The same applies to ASCO at that point.
Thanks, Minister. I now invite you, Ms. Mafu, to take us through.
Okay, I will be using this thing as a backdrop.
Honorable Chair, I omitted in introduction the Internal Audit Director, Ms. Gasamba, and the Director in the Office of the DG, Ms. Mwatoli. Honorable Chair, Mr. Rampele from Planning will take us through our presentation for the department. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable Minister and Honorable Members, I will take this opportunity to greet you and present the Department of Military Veterans Annual Performance Plan, which is the APP. Before I start, I just want to indicate that you received the overview of the annual performance plan, and we want to state up front to say when we say the table of content, it will be corrected, because we realize that the table of content, when it was interested, removed, as a result, the pages don't correspond with the heading, but I just want to say that beforehand. Now, in terms of presentation, honorable members, as the Honorable Minister indicated, that there are no changes as of what happened in 2018-2019. But because there were no members from that are in the committee, we have our needs to be concise to the point and also be really into the respect of. Now, this is the presentation outline. I'm not going to read it, but just to indicate that these are the issues that are contained in the presentation together with the APP. So, my dad mentioned what I see is the challenge.
Well, because we have these
so as I said earlier on, I'll be referring you to slide number, so that you can follow me when I do the presentation. In terms of the presentation outline, as I said, these are the headings that are there in the APP. And the aim of this presentation is to present the core corporate overview of the department, how we are going to function in as far as the 2019-20 financial year is concerned. We are saying as a department, when we go to slide number 5, we are aligned to this document. We don't just plan or do things out of, so it cut across all the departments. And then slide number 6, which is very critical, we are saying to the colleagues, these are the key policy considerations that we are going to focus in as far as the 2019-20 financial year is concerned. And the first one, alignment to the Vision 20 Faith, as you've realized recently during the sauna, there was the issue of the seven priorities. So when we'll be doing the budget speech, all those will be expanded will be clearly articulated to say this is what as a department we are going to contribute. And we are also aligned out with our as a department to the government outcome as you know them. And the other thing is that as a department we are on the process of amending the MVA, Military Veterans Act. That's the change is that I need to expand this application. And after the act is reviewed, then we go to the review of the Military Veterans Benefits Regulation. And then at the same time, we have got this task of reconfiguring the organizational structure of the department so that it speaks to the mandate of the department. We also want to make it a point that we make sure that education and health support is sustainable to military veterans because that is where our military veterans need to get to the benefit of what they're fought for. And we also plan to empower the military veterans in terms of program 3 in as far as skills development is concerned. And also form protocol agreements with the organ of state or provincial and national departments because that is what the Act says we should do as a department. And the other point is the honoring of the military veterans, as you know, that in life we need to give them what is due to them. We have got statutory bodies in the department. We also need to strengthen that cooperation. We have got the standbys, I'll talk it earlier on, the South African National Military Veterans Association, we've got the Appeals Board, we've got the Advisory Council. And the other thing is that as a department, we have developed the SDM, the Service Delivery Model, so that our services are decentralized. We know that we've got a challenge as far as the footprint in terms of the province where we are supposed to serve the military veterans as they are supposed. On slide 8, we have got to the vision of the department, which we always make sure that we adhere to this vision because it needs to make sure that all military veterans are empowered, are unified, and then they're given the dignity that they deserve. And how do we accomplish this vision through the mission, as you are indicating there? And then slide 9, it speaks about the values that we say as a department for us to deliver services to our clients, we need to follow this. We need to adhere to this values, teamwork, discipline. But as you know, that there are always challenges there and there, but it is what we are supposed to do. Now, in as far as the legislative department is concerned, we do align to PFMA Treasury Regulation, especially when we draft the document, they give us guidelines to say, when we do, this is what we need to do. I said earlier on slide 11 that this is the process that we are undertaking. I think as members, as time goes on, you'll be updated in as far as the process of the amendment and the review of the Military Veterans Benefits Association is concerned. Now, we do have the structure which to others looks that it is a top heavy. And I said earlier on that there is this process of reconfiguration to make sure that the services are dispensed to military veterans at the provincial level, at the municipality level. So there's a process that is undergoing in terms of the review of the program. So this is the structure that was approved when the department was in operation. So that is slide number 12 and 13. Slide 14, we just give the colleagues the status of what is happening in the department now that you've got permanent members. The whole approved structure has got 169 posts, but at the moment it's 138 that are filled in terms of the three programs as indicated there. We also indicate that we have got contract employees, and this is what how many we have absorbed in the department, and also the intent as part of the requirements in every department. You need to have intent to assist the department. Now, on slide 15 is about the layout of the APP. Remember, we said it cut across all the department, all the units. And then slide 16, I said earlier on that we align our activities in terms of the minister's executive priorities. We have got the NDP, we have got the outcomes, we have got the cost implementation. All this, they are the bedrock for us to make sure that we adhere to what is expected. Now, on slide 17, Chairperson, we have indicated the three programs. Program one is administration, program two is socio-economic support, program three is empowerment and stakeholder management. In the other slide, we will show that under program one, we have got about six sub-programs. Under program two, we have got about three sub-programs. Program three, we have got also about three sub-programs. So here we are just indicating the goal of each program and the objectives. Now, on slide 18, Chairperson, we are indicating to you the objectives of the department, that this is basically what we are doing. We are in the process of fulfilling, we are in the process of making sure that we adhere to what is mandated to us. Now, earlier on slide 19, I spoke about the executive authority priorities. You've got about seven of them, priority one, priority two, until number seven. So here we just outline to members to see, but when you go to the APP, it will tell you that under program one, this is what we are doing, and this is what we have aligned it to the NDP and also to the government outcomes. As you can see on slide 21 and slide 23, there we have got the contribution to ministers' priorities, to the outcomes, and to the NDP. So that's the alignment that when we report, we need to make sure that we align ourselves to this. So I'm not going to read the whole, but you can see that everyone has shown that we are contributing to the expectation of the department. The last part, on slide 24, we have got the foster implementation plan, which cut across all. When you talk of the foster chairperson, we talk of the Forum of South African Directors General. We also contributed the department that in terms of bullet number one, you can see that we must make sure that the disease performance agreement is signed. We have got what we call the SDIP Service Delivery Improvement Plan. We have got, we are here to the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. When they raise issues about military veterans, we need to respond. We have got, which is our main objective, to obtain an unqualified audit opinion, which is what we is required here, and we are also working to that. I believe one will be reported earlier, next time it will be very clear to what type of audit opinion we obtain. And that all senior managers must, the financial disclosures. The requirement is not a request that they need to do that. The presidential hotline, when they raise issues, there is a section that deals with that. And the other challenge is this 30-day notice, multi-day 30-day payment that all departments need to adhere to, because it is the requirement to make sure that the SMEs are paid off. Now, the following slide, on slide 26, is about the overall budget of the department. On slide 26, we have got program one. It has been allocated 136 million. Program two and program three, if you see them, they have been, the budget is higher because that is where the benefits are being implemented. So it is for the three year coming, but I'm just showing you the first column of the current year. And also the next slide is about the economic classification. In as far as the COE is concerned, goods and services transfers and payment of capital assets. So this is the position of the department in as far as the budget is concerned. It is the overall. Now, from slide 29, 30, 31, is the economic classification in terms of program one. That program one, as I said earlier on, that it has been allocated 136 million. Under COE, you have got 47, goods and services 79. So this is just the summary of the presentation. When you go to the APP, it details in terms of there's a part of that is the same as where it breaks down to say this will be for goods and services, this will be for this. So it is detailed in the APP, program one, program two, and program three. So this is, when you add all these, they make the overall budget of the department. Now, honorable members are aware that in the department we have got what we call it's across all the departments, we have got the E&E. There are certain indicators. When you talk of the E&E, the estimate of national expenditure, that is where most of the information in as far as the budget and the allocation, the breakdown and everything is outlined there. So we are just indicating that these are the indicators that we have put together in terms of the E&D, how the money will be used in terms of these indicators. And when you go to the APP as a footnote, it explains to you what each indicator entails. And at the same time, when you go to the APP at the back of the document, it speaks about what we call the TID, Technical Indicator Description, where it espouses to this indicator, what is its purpose, how are you going to get evidence. So there is that definition and explanation at the end of the document. When you go to slide 35, as I said earlier on, that we have got three programs in the department and their purpose. And now these are the sub-programs of each program. I'm not going to read it, Chairperson. And this is where now the real function of the department is measured in terms of the indicators. We see program one, which is a support function. We've got about seven indicators that we have indicated here in terms of what we want to achieve. Although the main things about program two and three. Program two is about social economic support. We've got about seven indicators that we have set ourselves. We've got healthcare, housing, we've got bursaries, we've got compensation, counseling. The other two indicators on pension and transport, we are saying this current year we are going to finalize the policy because we can't dispense the benefit without having a policy. So that is why when we check on the, in terms of the MTF projection, the current year we are finalizing the policy so that the next year, as you can see, that the target, that says we are targeting this X number of military veterans. So we are having close to seven benefits. And part of the money that I spoke about in terms of program two and three, that is where most of the money goes to in terms of allocation for military veterans to benefit in terms of healthcare, housing, bursaries, and so on and so on. The last part is program three, which is the empowerment and stakeholder management. We have got about five indicators that we have indicated here, and we have got five benefits also. We have got the partnership that I spoke about, and also the skill development program to empower the military veterans, and business opportunities to expose to military veterans in their lives, and also the various support that we give to military veterans. The last one is the memorial site. So all these documents, Chairperson, when you go in the APP, you go to, especially page 74 to 76, it speaks about the technical indicator description. You say this indicator, this is its purpose. So at this level, I don't think I will need to go deeper to say the purpose of this is this. But just to say, these are the benefits that we have planned to dispense to military veterans as far as the 2019-20 financial year is concerned. Lastly, Chairperson, we want to say, as we have presented, we have aligned this to the resolution priorities outcome. So we just hope that the PCT will support as the document has been taken in Parliament. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, colleagues. It is on the table. So we may then ask questions of clarity. May start with General Olumisa and then to Mr. Mack.
Chairperson, Honorable Minister, Honorable Members and Department staff. Military veterans who qualify to be a military veteran, point number one, because in a number of occasions you get letters of complaints from the public to say I was a member of AFLA, I was a member of MK, but I've not been catered for. Also, you see these days, 18, 19-year-olds, they are called veterans with uniforms, marching, streets. You see them in the rallies of political parties. they also qualify. Lastly, the issue of benefits for the veterans, in particular the housing. If a veteran is living in a rural area, do we cater for that individual, or do we allocate house or give people who are living in the urban areas? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question would be along what my general has just said here. Who is actually a military veteran? That needs to be honored. Because seemingly some of these benefits go to people who are in SADC. They need to be honored for upholding apartheid, or what are we actually saying? Because as I go through this, we only talk about liberation, struggle. We don't talk about anybody from the TVD state or from SADC. Then why are some of these people being included in this benefit? Or do we want to honor them for oppressing us? Or maybe that's why I see legislation amendment. Maybe we want to clarify some of those things in the amendment. Maybe that is the aim. The second question would be, what the regulations? You say you are going to review the regulations. What regulations are you using now? And what is the problem with the current regulations? Why do they need to be changed? And in the provinces, you said you need to decentralize services. What do you have in the provinces? If nothing, then it means somebody from the Eastern Cape must go to Pretoria, somebody from Messina must go to Pretoria in order to get services, which doesn't make any sense. My last question would be on on slide number 40. You say your plans and targets, percentage of approved burial claims paid within 30 days of receipt. Just wondering, what type of a target is that? A person is dead and you talk about 30 days. If a person died today, you must do that within 48 hours or within 24 hours. So what target is that? Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you so much, Mr. Matthias.
Look, this is your amazing day.
Shelley, you were next, and the Vickers were coming after you, Monte, and then Matthias. I'm sorry that I didn't come back to you. Mr. Mare, you are. I'm coming to you first.
Yeah.
Okay, Shelley, then I'll come back later.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question will relate to a situation where, say, a military veteran resides or stays in a rural area, and then in that case you find there is no, say like at the hospital or that is close, to that person, because I think one may refer that it should be within the 50 kilometers radius for that person to access the medical assistant. So in those cases, what is being done, are you sure that, all these military veterans where they stay, they are medical, support or hospital within that radius, as it's being said, in terms of, the guidelines here. So I think maybe you can give me the clarity on that. What is the situation for those people in those areas?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I must say that in Afrikaans we say this is a first of the hook road, but I hope my question will will be in the right context or what. My first one is on, if you look at the mission of the department or then it's like to facilitate delivery and coordinate all activities that recognize and entrench the restoration of dignity and appreciation of the contribution of military veterans to our freedom. Now, I'm not sure, but the presenter was saying when he referred to the organizational structure that it's provincial and not in municipalities. I'm not sure. But now I assume that you say that you're not in municipalities. Now, my question is, Chair, that are there any plans to integrate into municipalities or to liaise and cooperate with municipalities? Because the municipality is the sphere nearest to the people. And they need to implement that dignity and that cooperation and that appreciation of our military veterans. So I want to know what is the process, and also how can you, for example, include municipalities to, because in municipalities they don't know the real what they must do, and the military veterans in most municipalities or in our areas in those municipalities, they are not recognized or they don't know, there's no cooperation between the veterans and the municipalities or the councillors. That's my first question on the process to liaise with municipalities. And then a short one on the second one is the more clarity on the increasement of the fee of consultants in program 2. What will it be used for? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We welcome the presentation. I've got two questions. It's on program 1, on management. We have seen they have reduced significantly, as we welcome it, their budget from the last financial year to 7.1. If they can just privilege us with factors that contributed to that particular reduction. Secondly, on their housing program for veterans, do they have a database that is guiding them, and how far are they, if they have, in terms of that database? Because I see here on the outer years, they indicate that 2019-20 they will provide 400, 2021, 500, 600, so forth and so on. But according to my great R knowledge, is that such a program cannot be a program that does not come to an end. It's not like your RDP program. That speaks to also what the honorable members have raised to say, who are veterans? Because the program is meant to uplift certain people whom I think they at this point, you should be having a database of all of them, and you should be knowing how far are you in terms of that program, and how many are left, which must be addressed by that particular program. And the targets that you put for yourself, are they realistic? Because if you are relying on a department to do that for you, and you set targets for yourself, are they realistic? Are you able to meet those targets? If you say 400, the last financial year you have put thousands, have you reached that particular target? Are you sure you are going to reach that 400 in this financial year? And what are the challenges thereof? I think, Chair, that also speaks to, or let me phrase it in this way, access of veterans to services rendered by the department. Somewhere in the presentation that I have read, it speaks about monies that you have allocated for leases. I am not sure whether you are going to lease buildings across the country in provinces so that you enhance that challenge that veterans are experiencing in terms of accessing your offices. But my understanding is that if the department is available in all provinces, can't you consider sharing of space or offices if you've got offices across the country? And you'll save cost rather than leasing when you have buildings across which can be accessible. Or also considering the view that was raised here of utilizing or getting into under memorandum of understanding with municipalities for ease of access. It might save you cost as well. I think, Chair, if I can be clarified there, I'll pause here.
Mr. Matthews?
Thank you so much, Honourable Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation by the department, and hasten to state that we, from where we sit, our intention is to build strategic relationship with the coercive components of the state, the police and the ministry and the defence in particular. We understand the historic role of these in the context of the radical program of changing the country and place it on a different paradigm. However, we must hasten to say, Honourable Minister, that we are not 100% sure that these coercive component, particularly the ministry and the defence and the military, are sufficiently transformed. We believe that they are still anchored deeply in the pre-democratic apartheid colonial structure. The last 25 years of what has happened is the introduction of the civilian component in the ministry, which wasn't there before 1994. That is welcome, much appreciated. But the transformation agenda ought to go to a higher level. We have to undergo what we may, in other words, refer to as a radical paradigm shift. The civilian role and interface between armed forces and the people represented by ourselves and those that are mandated to sit and to serve as civilians in the ministry and in the department must go beyond the boardrooms, must go and beyond the battle, and must find concrete expression between the military and the masses of our people. That hasn't yet been achieved. because the military is still in barracks. We ought to go out of the barracks and do something in fulfilling the new democratic aspirations of the country, contribute towards RDP objectives, reconstruction development program, and all of that. Now, getting to the presentation. We are not so much sure whether what the presentation refers to here as socio-economic support really achieves what it's supposed to achieve. Is the budget allocation sufficient to attend to veterans of war and their families as well as taking care of the welfare of the families beyond the lifespan of war veterans? Once the veteran passes on, are there mechanisms to take care of the families, the children's education, the medical care, and so forth and so on? Second, is there any program in place over and above what happened around Duval with the cleaning of the Duval River? Any program that takes up the military to contribute in I beg your indulgence, Honorable Chair, if you can just be patient. Perhaps this would be the last question. Any program of the military that go beyond the defense of the borders? I'm struggling between the two. Yes, it's deliberate. It's deliberate. Because there shouldn't be any Chinese wall between the military veterans and the defense. And if that is the case, it's one of the weaknesses. And that weakness ought to be corrected. That weakness ought to be corrected. Building silos between the two components, the defense and the military veterans. That ought to be corrected. The Chinese wall ought to be, ought to fall. And until such time that the Chinese wall collapses, falls, would not be able to realize the democratic aspirations of the country. Would relate with the military veterans as a standalone, as a welfare arrangement for military veterans. We ought to transcend that paralysis. It's dangerous. It ought to be addressed. And if there is no instrument in place to address it in a form of a legislation or in a form of a regulation, we ought to venture into that space, develop a legislation that measures the two components and deal with them as one, even if we may seek to separate them for purpose of presentation. But in concrete expression of the work of the ministry, the military component as well as the veterans component ought to be integrated and must be pursued as one.
Thank you so much, Mr. Murray.
Thank you very much, Chair. I want to start off by saying that I think the Act is clear in terms of who's supposed to be a military veteran, but I think what we struggle with sometimes is the age cutoff, because there's been a lot of questions on that, and I think that must be just be made very clear again. What is the age cutoff in terms of who's military veterans? On the database, if I'm correct, I want to make sure whether the database has been completed and what is the status of the database. If I recall correctly from the past, the numbers is not the 17 or 18,000 that is mentioned here, but it's probably around about 60, 70,000 that is preliminary in terms of military veterans. So obviously it is important to know that in terms of who really qualifies to be military veterans. If we look at the total budget, although there's a marginal increase in the budget, my suspicion is that it is not even close enough anyway in terms of what is required for military veterans, the objectives and the targets. So maybe the department can and the minister can tell us what is the pie in the sky, in other words, the reach for the stars. What would be a reasonable requirement, irrespective of the budget allocation, so that we can just try to get to grips with this elephant in the room, because we can work with a budget, but it can probably not satisfy a fraction of the needs for military veterans in terms of who qualifies for military veterans. And then it is also important to know who is the dependence of these military veterans, and are they being provided for specifically with regards to health services. I think that is one of the most frequent requirement or inquiries that we receive as members of parliament from military veterans, and that is in terms of health, access to health services. I know that in the past there was discussions that the health services will be outsourced, especially in the rural areas, where military veterans might not even be close to one of the military hospitals. What is the status and the progress with regards to that, and what are the needs in with regards to that? I have seen that the outsourced services increased from 100,000 rand to 5.2 million. So obviously whether that has got to do with that, I don't know, and I would please like to get some feedback with regards to that. On the housing, again, you know, there's a projected drop from 1,000 to 400 in terms of housing. While I know from the past, in terms of presentations, the major needs are housing, health, assistance with burials, and education of the children or the dependents of military veterans. How can we have a drop in the support for housing, while we know that there's probably a huge increase in the demand and the need for housing? And also those numbers of military veterans, the increase of 1,000, it seems like a lot, but in terms of the total probably need is 1,000, is a drop in the ocean. How are we going to overcome this? And what are the discussions going on? Are there discussions with the Department of Health and the SA Military Health Services in terms of how health services will be provided in the future? Because somehow we must try to understand so that we can give support to you, and that we can obviously give, you know, the feedback to those military veterans with a real need and support for basic services. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Colleagues, yes. Oh, you wanted to work this one. Mr. Michael?
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry about that. On the question of housing, in fact, the real question is how do you allocate these budgets to the programs? Practically, military veterans at this point in time are above a certain age, as the general was saying. They can't be 20 years. They are going 40, maybe about 45 to 50. And if you are going to build the houses for them, and let's say they are 10,000, then you have got 400 on your budget.
Mm.
What are you actually telling us? You can't finish them. Or what is your method of doing it? Do you do it according to age, so that this one mustn't die before he gets the house? Because if this is the case, then there's no way in which you can build the houses for them. It means they must stay in shacks and you build 400. How do you get to such a target? Is it because you don't have money, or it's just not practical? I mean, what informs the 400? It means all of them will die without houses. That is what it means. Can you check this?
I covered all the questions that I wanted to pose have actually been posed by the members, except to highlight two issues. One is the status of the military deterrent database. Is a big bomb for the delivery of services to the department. The sooner we get it right, we get that right, the better. That's number one. And number two, I am looking at your APP and the presentation that you have given this morning. I don't see where you indicate the actual performance against your targets for 18-19. To be able to appreciate the targets that you are placing for this financial year, 19-20. For example, if in the previous year you said 1,000 houses, 18-19, to deliver for military veterans, and this year you are saying 400. Now, until I get what the actual delivery for 18-19, I will not be convinced that the 400, you know, is not a thumbs up, or what actually informs it. You know, maybe the budget that we have money, but I want to compare the current year's performance against the previous year's performance. And the last point, it's your delivery mode of the housing benefits. If you could just give me clarity on that one. And that takes care of my questions in relation to the first round. Should there be a need for a second round, we will take a second round. But of course, that depends on how you respond to the questions that are on the table right now. Honourable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chairperson, Honourable Member. Let me start by saying the matter raised by Honourable General of to a military veteran is actually a very sensitive matter. Now, I'm not going to talk about the definition as it stands in the legislation. I'm going to talk about practical experience that we have. When the legislation clearly was drafted, we all had in mind military veterans from the liberation struggle, those who were fighting against injustice, those who were fighting to liberate South Africa. I think when people were brainstorming, that's what we had in mind. However, let me just remind the honorable members as well that this department was established even before legislation had been passed. So policy formulation came in later after a department had been already established. So you had some kind of a draft kind of policy. But experience which you have now informs, that is why you're talking about an amendment of the legislation and a development of new regulations. Experience has it that it's not necessarily that kind of veteran you are dealing with. If I may cite this, you have, for instance, military veterans who come from the PPD system, and I want to single them out away from the SADF. Okay? You have quite a number of those military veterans who are equally destitute. Now, those are people who are coming from the statutory forces. We have in mind non-statutory forces. Budget is as such. But the reality on the ground is that you do have military veterans who come from such former statutory forces who are as destitute as our own military veterans. And therefore, when that military veteran walks in and says, I want this education benefit, or I want this health benefit, it's difficult for you to say, no, you don't qualify, because in terms of the intention we had, we wanted to look after those who were fighting in the liberation struggle. Now, you then have what was referred to as one of the entities, which is an association really of military veterans, SANVA. SANVA is an umbrella body of all, both statutory and non-statutory forces. Now, within SANVA, you do have, for instance, people who are represented, military veterans who are represented by CMVO, which is a military veterans association which is aligned to former statutory forces. Okay? Now, most of the time, people will come to the Department of Military Veterans through that SANVA. And you can't say SANVA cannot be a representative of both military, non-statutory and non-statutory forces. It's the representative of all military veterans. I'm taking it from there because I know that later on, as you familiarize yourselves with the work you're going to do, there will be time when you come and say, why, for instance, are you recognizing a particular entity? Please bear in mind that we have an obligation. All those who are affiliated to SANVA and are proven to be military veterans, we have an obligation to support. We then have a situation again where you have now military veterans who are joining the queue, who are coming from the current South African National Defense Force. How do you define them? They are military veterans. Whether now the legislation as it is currently crafted, the intention of having a Department of Military Veterans was to give support to these military veterans is another mess. But the reality is that once you have undergone military training, you are a military veteran. So, when we talk about amendments and developing new regulations, in the main it has to do with that. Because it's very difficult to respond to the question which the general is raising. Who is a military veteran? A military veteran. Military veteran, you and I understand it to be a person who has been trained militarily. But we have another category. self defense units who were trained by military veterans themselves in the country and therefore participated in the struggle for the emancipation of our people. So when you go to the database, you will also find that category, the SDN. They are self-defense units. They are not military veterans. These are products of the military veterans themselves. And whether fortunately or unfortunately, that's another category you will find in your database. You also now have this MSDS program. This is a very good program of the Defense Force. Now, that's a two-year program. There's an expectation that those who have been part of that MSDS, when they leave the Defense Force after 2 years, right, they also come to the back of the queue of the Department of Military Defense. Can you question? They are military veterans because they have been trained. Hence the need for us, with regards, now that we have the necessary experience, the need for clarity on some of these issues. Better clarity than how our current legislation is crafted. So you have different categories, people who are calling themselves military veterans. Then the general goes on to say, you see 19, 18, 19 year olds, those are not military veterans, they can never be, they were not even part of the self-defense unit. Those are beneficiaries by virtue of being dependents of military veterans. So 18, 19 year old would be my children. And I always say, my children can never call themselves military veterans, because they haven't gone through what I have gone through. So my children are dependent, and by virtue of being my children, are therefore beneficiaries of some of the benefits we're rolling out, such as the education system. Because if you look at the rest of the benefits, they are meant for strictly a military veteran. But if you talk education support, then you bring in dependents of military veterans. That is who we pay for. That is who we provide support to. But to call themselves military veterans is completely invasive. So the department on, I think last week on Friday, we had a workshop. No. General, we are now in the sixth administration, General.
Okay,
we're starting off, right? No, so what you find sometimes, Chair, when you engage with us, we'll always tell you that our database is challenged. Our database has enormous problems. And it has to do with the fact that my child, who is a 23, 24-year-old, cannot be a military veteran. My child needs to understand he is simply a dependent, and the only thing he benefits from is the education support from military veterans. That's all. The rest of the other benefits are benefits which are meant strictly to look after military veterans. I hope I've clarified that particular issue. Now, Honorable Maogisi then raises the matter of, are we saying we support, I think I've answered this question about whether we support even those who are in statutory forces. Currently the position is such that it is a reality that some of them are on the database, and it is difficult to say if we can support you, because the reality is that some of them. Now, you also raised Ubuntu. We have a target of 400. Remember, this we're dealing with an ATP for 1892. 1920. That is the ATT. Yes, you are correct. There may be 10,000 people who do not have housing. But you also have to set a realistic target for the department. Remember, we are simply facilitating for housing. We do not build housing. And in fact, for me, that is one of the biggest challenges with the Department of Police. We are more of a facilitating department than an implementer of some of the people who are responsible for rolling out some of the benefits which are outlined in our legislation. Now, if we may be honest, if you look at the last year, we, if somebody in your annual, in our annual report, you see that, for instance, we surpassed the target, and you see that we are 600. The question I have, which we were discussing when we were together as with the team, is you can't proudly say I've delivered 600 houses, because the 600 houses come from one province, and that is Gauteng, for instance, because it's been offered houses, land and houses which are to be built in Ekurhuleni. So that's about 600 houses we've been offered, right? Now, are you going to say you've met your target and you didn't surpass? No, because that in fact is not, your 400 target is a national target. You ought to get houses for veterans all over the country. But if you're going to get it 400 in one province, it creates a bit of a challenge. So that's one of the things we are trying to grapple with. It is not all the provinces, much as they get the money from DMZ, not all the provinces which are prioritizing military veterans. Right from the beginning, we were told that as the department was being established, that you can only facilitate, you will not be able to deliver on a mandate of another government department. So yours is to submit a list to the Department of Human Settlement, but also transfer money to the Department of Human Settlement so that they in turn can then build the houses for you. But guess what? What happens in the municipality is people don't necessarily prioritize veterans. So there is a skewed, there's a definite unevenness and imbalance in the manner in which houses are provided to military veterans. The colleagues are going to help me here. In some of the areas, we work very closely, Honorable Duke, with municipalities. If you look, for instance, in the Eastern Cape, in the area called Lukanji, in the Free State, there, municipalities indeed are prioritizing military veterans. But in some of the areas, you don't, even though money has been transferred into the accounts of other government departments. You raise issues of transformation, a need for a radical paradigm shift, military still in the barra, and hopefully when the general presents the ATPs on the Department of Defense, we will then deal extensively with those issues. Just to say that the ministry, yes, it's one ministry, but we have two separate departments, the Department of Defense and the Department of Military Veterans. And each one has its own accounting officer. Each one has its own community. So when we get there, we then provide answers which is a matter of reference. I think that allows me to hand over to the management to respond to some of the issues, and if we are not able to cover my time.
Thank you, Chair. I will allow CFO to first deal with issues of budget related, and then Ms. Murolo will deal with issues related to health, housing, and health, housing, I think those are the two, and then we will take it from there.
Thank you, Chair, Minister, Honourable Members. Just to highlight, because ideally I would have liked to go question for question, but ideally it will be prudent that then I then just highlight to the committee the way we get funded. Because if the funding that is available with competing priorities, where then one has to then allocate the funds accordingly. Unfortunately, we don't work on an activity-based budgeting process. Unfortunately, in government, it's not always practical. So there will always be competing priorities, even prior to us receiving an allocation from Treasury Chair. So then, as a department, as soon as we receive the allocation letter, we will then sit, look at what we are mandated to deliver, mainly prioritizing services to military veterans. I think from the total allocation, I think it's prudent that, because there was a question to say, are we funded enough based on the mandate of the department? The answer is, Chair, if we were delivering on all the services, the answer is no, we are not fully funded. We've got cost pressures in the key areas, which is mainly provisioning of health, as well as education, as well as housing in itself. The advantage that we have as a department on housing at the moment is the mistake we did in the previous years, where we then did pre-transfers, which are forbidden by PMSA. However, the money was paid already to certain provinces. So then we then decided on a new model, funding model, with those provinces to say we will pay you upon delivery of a house. So they're sitting with the funds, so we are amortizing as they deliver on those units. And then you'll see a slight a reduction in the budget in the current financial year and subsequent years. And that is also linked to the number of units budgeted for, because we've looked at history in terms of what the provinces have delivered. So sometimes we have to be realistic, because we don't build, but we facilitate the list, and then we then provide to a human settlement for them to deliver on our behalf. So you will see the numbers have been decreased drastically from 1,000 each year to then 400 and going up for the next financial year. We were trying to be realistic then over promising. And it's important then I then state, Chair, that of the 662.6 million, 64% of that goes to benefits. So it means that 46%, of which 20% of the total budget is allocated to cost of employment, and then 3% is for capex, and then operational cost of the balance. So you can see that we are prioritizing service delivery based on the resources that we have as a department, and this is, I think, it's prudent to mention. And then coming directly to the issue, because I just want to take two specific questions. Mainly it was the reduction in management. I think it was a question that was raised. Under management is the office of the accounting officer. That's what it symbolizes under the program one. So in there we also pay for advisory council and the appeals board, as well as we do fund SANVA. We've got a ring-fenced amount. It's important then I also mention that those statutory bodies are not budgeted for when we get the allocation from Treasury. So it means that immediately when we ring fence the funds, we ring fence the funds based on what DMV should have. So it's the discussion that we are still having with National Treasury to say, Treasury, please remember that these statutory bodies, they will require funding. So Treasury is also advising us in terms of how best we can fund them moving forward. So that reduction mainly on management, it was then assessing what funds are required going forward when we pay the advisory council and the appeals board for their assisting. So it was aligned to the planned activity. And then there was another question. I think I've explained the drop in the housing budget as well as the number targeted. And then there was a question in terms of the increase in outsourced services. And maybe I should link that to the payment within 30 days, because the member was also saying, yes, we should pay within 48 hours, which is, yes, it's true. It's what we also try to do every time we receive an application from the interpreters, because they are destitute at that time. So we endeavor to pay them within 48 hours, or even shorter. We have a special arrangement that we've done with Treasury where we do an overnight payment. But that is pending approved documentation. I should state that, Chair. It's important that approved documents must be in place. But however, the question was to say, why pay within 30 days? I just need to just clarify. We used to have a target which was saying we're targeting a number, say 200. Military veterans to be buried. Then that target then indicated that I was planning to kill I was planning to kill 200 military veterans. The answer is no, because you cannot plan for something that you cannot anticipate to happen. But the idea was to say, how do we expedite assistance to military veterans, because that's our target, is to then ensure that military veterans are buried with dignity. And hence then we said we must endeavor to pay them within at least the Treasury regulated system, which is 30 days. But we endeavor to expedite it faster than that, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Member. I think my point in housing and healthcare support has been partially handled by the colleagues, especially the CFO, who has now just shed light in terms of how the housing is being funded, and the Minister emphasized to the partners, the co-partnership. So the issue of housing is more on the modalities of delivery of housing. How do we deliver housing, and hence the targets the way they are, as well as hence the delivery scheme. It's the issue of the dependency, the issue of aligning whatever that we have with the partners. So that is why there was a claim in how we are achieving the targets for the stage of the. But I must say that the demand is much more than what we see in our ACT in terms of housing. Because our starting point is from the applications that we see from members who indicate to us that they don't have housing. And then we look at the resources that we have and say what is it that we can provide. Also taking into cognizance that we might have a housing need maybe in the Eastern Cape, but the development in terms of human settlement is happening with another problem. So those are the things that we don't have control over because we don't build housing systems. So you have to look at the areas where municipalities are having credit fines and so forth and so forth. I had a question about the issue of housing in rural areas. With the current modality and the regulation, we haven't factored the issue of already serving, I mean of existing side that many military veterans have. But within the department, in terms of looking at how we can facilitate, we're also talking about the issue of ensuring that maybe we factor in our regulations the issue of renovation of housing. But we also have a challenge in terms of going that way, because how do you renovate get that person who's homeless altogether? So it's an issue of looking at how you prioritize the delivery of the services in line with the challenges that we have initially as well as the regulations that guide us in the delivery of those services. And then the second part that relates to the issue of how do we decide who to give the house when there are 10,000 applicants. I think that has been explained by the CFO and the minister, but it would have been ideal that we can be able to give everybody who does not have a house, but we don't also consider the issue, because sometimes we find that the elderly, if an elderly person would have loved them to have a house before they start, but you find that the even intervention at that point in time, who is younger than the elderly, who is looking in the street. So also this issue of the definition of the intervention impacts on how we deliver on the benefits, because as the minister has alluded that we've got our 24-year-olds who have served for 2 years, they have been trained for 2 years, and then they were not kept in the DOD, then they come and become intervention. They are destitute, they don't have work, they don't have money. You have to see how we can be the because of the definition. Then the issue of healthcare, which is quite a sensitive and complicated one, in a sense that we are currently depending on our South African military health service, which we are all aware that they, in terms of the geometry and their radius, does not address all the military veterans in the country. Previously, through FEMS, we had the benefits because they were outsourcing. They had the service providers that they had in the communities where the military, the healthcare facilities are outside the FEMS facilities. And then those South African military healthcare services. Yeah. So they will be seamless. But then due to budget challenges in terms of administration, because it's not like we are getting the health services from them for free. The department pays for services that are delivered through the South African military health services. And then the second problem that is created by that is the fact that in this category of military veterans, we have military veterans that are from the statutory forces who exit the defense having purchased a military medical scheme, they retire with that benefit of the medical aid. And that medical aid is not serviced internally inside them.
They use that medical aid of theirs to even go and consult outside the country. So it creates that disparity in terms of the delivery of services to the same category of medical veterans. That medical service of theirs, that medical aid that they have, they exit with, also takes care of the dependents. Whereas in the case of the NSF category, it does not take care of the dependents of military veterans. Hence, you find that now we have those challenges. We are looking at issues of, we have sent for requests for information to look at an issue of saying that maybe the ones that do not have a cover from DOD, we look at issues of maybe having GEMS covering them, but then we have to be mindful of the budget and the fact that that will be a non-contributory package if we give them that package, which means that it will mean that we take this budget that we have for healthcare, we put it to whatever modality that will assist us. We are looking at issues of partnering with the DOH, Department of Health. We have spoken to them on numerous occasions. But their mandate does not allow them to discriminate, to give preference over the entire South African citizenry to the other category of South Africans. The least that they can do is to maybe have lines where maybe you are given priority in terms of being checked or whatever. But it does not necessarily mean that if there's a competition for maybe a transplant or for a dialysis or whatever, they will give a military veteran over the other South African cities' interest. So that then, therefore, tells us that we need to find a modality that we will use for us to be able to address these imbalances in the terms of the healthcare for military veterans. So I think I can end up there. But what we do currently, they go to them, and then we assist also in terms of transportation of them in areas where they are far from SEMS facility. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, I'll then move to the remaining questions. The first one was to say, why are we not reporting on performance in relation to 2018-19 financial year? Just to confirm that in our annual report when we come to present that, we take care of performance information. And I'll then deal with our intention of decentralizing services to provincial offices. I want to confirm that at the moment we have offices in Eastern Cape, in Mpumalanga, and in Northern, in Northwest. And the reason why we're having a slow pace in opening those offices is because we depend on Department of Public Works. We don't procure direct. As an attempt, knowing our situation and our limitation in terms of budget, we then facilitated a protocol agreement where we say to provincial governments of the services that we are supposed to be providing for military veterans, come to the party, assist us. We have signed a protocol agreement in the Eastern Cape, and the benefits of that protocol agreement were able to negotiate a job placement, were able to negotiate empowerment, whether it's through tenders. We also are able to sit around the table and say, in an ex-hospital which is closer to military veterans, is there a chance that you can provide a chronic medication to houses of military veterans? Also, are you able, when they come to that hospital, that they join what is referred to as a fast lane, which is meant for disabled people, elderly and pregnant women? So we are doing our best to facilitate service delivery for military veterans. We have presented to SALGA, which is a coordinating body for municipalities, and again with SALVA to achieve what we have with the protocol agreement. We have made presentation with the provincial government of Northwest and Mpumalanga, and we haven't been successful, but we are not losing hope. We are targeting that in this financial year, at least we'll sign a four protocol agreement with a provincial government. I also want to deal, Chair, with the issue of MOUs as part of partnerships. Again, knowing that we have limitations, we signed with different government departments and state, with other state institutions, even with private sector. We have at a certain stage gone to ESCOM to ask for employment opportunities, and just when we were about to sign, then there was change of leadership, but we will continue to facilitate this. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks. I'm not going to take the second round. We have gone beyond the time we have allocated to this. So tell me towards the end as to what we're going to do with whatever questions that you may have now. But for now, we'll move forward. But there are two things that we need to do a quick follow-up on. One, there are services that the department relies on partnership with other departments to deliver. All right? We need to identify those services and then make and then devise a way of actually monitoring the delivery by this department through other departments on an ongoing basis. All right? Because they are posting the targets, but the actual achievement against the tech department is dependent largely on Department A that they have a partnership with, or Department B or Department C, whatever it is. All right. So we need to pay a closer attention to those, and because there's money that we put aside for the achievement of those targets. One and two. The second point is the qualification, you know, it seems to be muddied a bit. I think that requires, I think the minister says we really need clarity on this one. Who must qualify to receive the benefits in terms of the Act? If the Act itself is not clear, so we must make the Act clear. If we have to discriminate, and that discrimination must be in the Act, it must be very clear that on this one, we are discriminating for the following reasons. I think the Constitution does allow to discriminate in certain instances, but of course, the Act must be compliant with the Constitution. So that is the area. I mean, like now, they are saying you go on a two-year program, and if you are not absorbed, then you then go out and stand in the queue, and you then become a military veteran. Yeah. So I think the thing is open-ended. So when you are active, you remember you are in DOD. When you are no longer active, so you then become a military veteran, and therefore, in terms of benefits, in terms of the military veteran, I don't know. I think there is. Otherwise, you, this military veteran department is not is going to sack. So we've got to purify the issue of beneficiaries insofar as the definition is concerned. All right. So, as with the rest, we leave it to our discussion when we formulate our own report going forward. But so far, I think all questions have been answered by the officials. Can we, on this note, move forward, colleagues? I think so. We right. Yes, ma'am.
I think it would be unfair not to just sensitize the committee about a directive which I issued to the department vis-a-vis health support. You know, let me just give you a practical example where a military veteran with family, let's say they are involved in a car accident. Our responsibility is to move into the area and give whatever medical support to the veteran. And some veterans have come back to say, but really, if I'm in a car accident, minister, what do you do? So all you do is to attend to me. What about my family? And so I'm just saying that these are some of the practical experiences which we have. Military veteran is sitting with a partner who is affected by a stroke in the middle of nowhere. Military veteran picks up the phone and says, I need help. What do you say? Because as we do our work, we have also to demonstrate high levels of compassion. Now, that's the area of health. And I'm saying I've requested the team to look into possibilities of extending this health benefit beyond the military veteran. But the question is, if you extend beyond the benefit, beyond the military veteran and extend it to the dependents, how many dependents are we talking about? I think that's the biggest headache for the Department of Military Veterans. If I have 19 children, does it mean that all my 19 children must be accommodated? That's the one area of help.
There's
no precedent. Now, the other area is that of housing itself. We are beginning to pick up a challenge that there are veterans. Remember, we started service department now in 2009, 10, 11. Military veterans have been there. This student came in 1994. So there's a backlog of some of these things. And in the course of that, some of the military veterans have passed on. And they've left widows and children behind. Okay? And if the man had been there or the woman had been there with a military veteran, obviously this person would have benefited from the housing scheme. What do you do? Do you say, no, I can't help because this person is not the actual military veteran? So those are some of the challenges that we have to deal with. And I'm glad that it's the
Minister, we're flagging the issue.
Yes.
Because we'll not finalize it now. We see it as a problem that really must receive our attention going forward. All right. So we close this issue on that note. On closing, we welcome the Deputy Minister. Your apology has been conveyed. And with that, we then move forward. Deputy Minister, I'm welcoming you. Deputy Minister, I'm welcoming you. Yes. On that note, we will then move on to take a presentation. You want a cover break? Can you take a 5 minute cover break before we launch into the other one? Thank you. In the meantime, the members, for everybody. Okay, there's three colleagues at the back.
Look how we're doing. No, no, you may continue up there.
the second item, the minister will appoint the introduction and then invite the person who's going to launch into the actual presentation.
Minister?
Okay. Chairperson, very briefly, just to say that, indicate that this is a very vast portfolio of defense and military veterans. The sole established with a constitutional mandate for the defense of our country's national sovereignty and territorial integrity. This, through the SANDF and all other entities that are in support thereof, as we present our APT, the Portfolio Committee is taken into confidence and its support sought to enable us to execute our mandate. Further, as we appear before you, it is in the context of a severely constrained national system, which has had a devastating impact on the conduct of our business and the fulfillment of our obligations. We therefore, as we present, Chair, would like to urge honorable members to scrutinize the document we are presenting to see how the budgetary cuts have affected the work of the Department of Defense, our programs related to the SANDF itself, and I guess at this point, Chair, once the presentation has been done, we will also be able then to respond to some of the concerns which were raised by Honorable Matthias. On that note, Chair, I'm joined now by the Deputy Minister. I will now hand over to the Chief of Staff of the SANDF, General Masondo.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Minister, Honorable Deputy Minister, and all Honorable Members. First, I want to start by correcting an omission I did when I made the introduction that I just introduced the members without indicating their portfolio or designation, which I would start by doing that. Next to me, Chair, is Ms. Timiliga. She's the Chief Director of Budgeting. And then next to her, in civilian clothes, which I must have apologized, is Major General Ramatswani. He's not in uniform because he arrived this morning and had to rush straight here. So he is a Chief Military... And then is the Major General Thomas Wan, with the Chief Military Police in Strategic Planning. I thought there would be confusion to say maybe we bring civilians, we keep them rent, we grow on. Next to General Ramatswana is Brigadier General Kulare, Director of Planning. And next to him is Mr. Cox, is Director of Strategy and Planning in the Secretariat. And Mr. Deputy Director. So Deputy Director of Planning, Strategy and Planning. Having done the introduction, Honorable Chair, just to finalize the program of the last session, if there you permit me, so that I
these are all the questions that we have posed to Mr. Matthews before we start the presentation.
No, let's do the presentation.
Okay.
We'll begin with the questions.
Okay, thank you.
Honorable Chair, just as before he proceeds, just to put it in correct perspective. My name is Matthias. Those who are from the English, they will write it as and pronounce it as Matthias, M-A-T-T-H-I-S, right? So mine is a sort of version of the English version. So there's the guy here in South Africa called Matthias Raff. So if you have a problem of pronouncing the way I write it, just pronounce it as you refer to the gentleman called Matthias Raff. That's the English version, yeah.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, of course, the Minister has already made the opening remarks. From my side, I just want to make one brief remark. To say as a department, we are excited when both Cabinet and this August Body Parliament actually approve the defense review 2015. Because we thought we'd experience better funding to be able to execute our mandate as the SANDF. But at the same time, quite aware of the economic challenges facing the country, but wish to say, also in our personal capacities, when we are faced with challenges, one of the things that suffers first is our insurance cover. The SANDF is like an insurance cover for the nation. And of course, you know, when you don't pay your premiums, you think you are saving yourself for that time. But when something big happens and you lose a major asset, and then that's where you realize that. So I thought I would make it. The presentation itself will be made by General Ramatswana, after which we then respond to the questions of honorable members. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chairperson, honorable members, I've already been introduced, and I'll go straight to the presentation itself, starting with the scope of the presentation, and that is the strategic overview, and in the strategic overview, I'll deal amongst other matters with the situational awareness that is key to the Defence Force moving forward, and I'll also deal with areas of performance delivery. And I'll also then look again at organizational environment, looking at the macro organization of the DoD itself. And secondly, when it comes to the strategic overview, I'm going to be looking at matters of budget allocation, including the expenditure estimates, and I will also therefore then deal with the programs themselves and the sub-programs, looking mainly to the selected performance indicators and the links to other plans, which I'll then explain. And therefore, then the aim of the presentation, honorable members, is to brief this out in terms of the ATP of the Department of Defense 2019. And as a point of introduction, I would like to indicate the fact that these were drawn up, this ATP, based on the guidelines that legislative guideline as well as the systems that are provided to us as a guide for the development of the annual performance plans, and this includes the Public Finance Management Act, the Treasury Regulations, and the National Treasury Framework for Strategic Planning, Treasury Regulations 2005, that's Chapter 18. And the Public Service Regulations of 2001, National Treasury Guide for Preparation of Annual Reports and Annual Performance Plans, and our own DoD Functional and Support Guidelines for 2019-20 to 2021 as promulgated. Bearing in mind, we are dealing, as the Minister, the Honorable Minister stated, that we are in the 2019-20 ATP. Moving over to part A of the presentation, which is a strategic overview, I'll then be looking at the vision of the Department of Defense, which we have derived
in the course of writing the white paper on defense, and that is effective defense for a democratic South Africa, and the mission encompasses the value chain of the Department of Defense, which is the one of preparing of forces by the service chiefs and providing them for forced employment and then managing all defense capabilities commensurate for the defense of RSA. And then moving forward, honorable members, I am on slide number 8, where now this is where we derive our mandate from, and this is the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. And on this one, we are in chapter 11, abuse with security services. And as for defense, the Constitution states that it is the only lawful military force in the Republic of South Africa, and that the defense force must be structured and managed as a disciplined military force with a prime object to defend and protect the Republic of South Africa.
Further,
it is stated that there is a political responsibility to defense, and that is a member of cabinet. In this case, it is the Minister of Defense. And only the president, as head of the national executive, may authorize the employment of the defense force in cooperation with the staff in defense of the Republic and in fulfillment of international obligations. As for command of the defense force, it indicates, therefore, in the Constitution, it indicated that the president, as the head of the national executive, is commander-in-chief of the defense force. And command of the defense force must be exercised in accordance with the directions of the cabinet member, who is the Minister of Defense in this case. And that we do have a civilian secretariat that is established by means of the Constitution itself. If I may start, honorable members, with the update of the situational awareness, starting with the political side. South Africa, the DOD is ready to support regional and continental security as derived, of course, from our policy document, our foreign policy of the Republic of South Africa, the national security strategy that also indicated the need for this. And we will support departments through general military assistance, and we will also support through peacekeeping operations, United Nations peace missions, as well as the African Union peace missions. And we will also, which we have done, that is to pledge our forces for the African Standby Force. Honorable members, moving over to the economic side of the slide, and currently the decreasing foreign investment and leading to unemployment, which may result in a lot of actions that may take place. And therefore, then the defense force might also be required to assist here. Where we find ourselves in, actually not assisting only in these areas, there will be also the other areas. We find ourselves at less than 1% of the defense budget of the GDP, as indicated in this particular slide. And this, therefore, has got an adverse impact when it comes to the issues of implementing the national policy, which was approved by both houses of parliament, the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, the 4th and the 24th of June, 2015. And this, therefore, as I am indicating, has got that major impact. And in the defense review, one of the things was for us to have the defense funding model. And the defense funding model, which we have put on the ground, and there was also a deliberation in this regard with the budgetary task team that was established between National Treasury and the Department of Defense. And in those deliberations, we have indicated the requirements from the Department of Defense. Honorable members who were still part of the Portfolio Committee on Defense in the 5th Administration will recall that jointly the DOD and National Treasury, we appeared before the PCD to explain, to discuss this particular matter. Then there's an area of sustainable development goals which are built upon the Millennium Development Goals. And there is 17 of these sustainable development goals, out of which we participate in goal number 16, which has got to do with promoting peace and inclusive societies for sustainable development, and providing access to justice for all, and build effective, accountable, and inclusive institutions at all levels. This is where the DOD will contribute in the main contributing the what we have within the DOD to peace missions, therefore participation in peace missions. And that will be our involvement. Honorable members, when it comes to social issues, we know the challenges that are there. One of it being a major one, and that is the influx of illegal immigration into the country. And therefore, as a result, we will be involved in border safeguarding. It's not only illegal immigration that's happening in our borders. There's quite a myriad of issues that are happening there, but we will be placed, we will continue our deployments in the border areas. But we are going to retain the strength of the current strength of our subunit, which is 15 subunits, and that is what we have stated in our annual performance plan for border safeguarding. Reasons clearly stated in the preamble by the Minister of Defense, where we are experiencing a lot of budget cuts to be able to upscale, which we would have wanted to do so, not just to upscale, but as well to put force multipliers in our border area. And therefore then, I want to move over to slide number 12, where I want to speak about the health service delivery. We'll continue, we've got the military health service, and as you probably have heard from the military veterans, they are some of the clients of the military health service in terms of health provision, and we continue to provide that health service wherein within the DOD, what the military health does is they provide it in two ways, one supporting the defense community, in other words with their families, and being able to support military operations. We're going to continue to do this. But what is worth noting is in the military health environment, it's an increased patient population in there, and the cost escalation with regards to pharmaceuticals and medical consumables that requires additional funding. Now, this is an environment as well which we need to look at and to make sure that moving forward that we are able, because as people, as you have the patient population that's in the hospital, you still have to attend to them. Again, we've got the national health insurance that is on this particular one. Our military health services are in touch with the Ministry of Health, and therefore, if there is any need for us to include some of the areas that are defined within the national health insurance, that's something that we are going to be doing. Our contribution in terms of the employment of youth, we are doing so. We are supporting the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, wherein we are having an intake of about 2,000 members. And we are using what we have to train them. In the main, which are the youth, and it's mainly on character building in assisting the Department of Land Reform. Internship is what we do as well as the DOD, which actually every other state department is also doing the same. And therefore, we'll continue to do this. I'm moving over to the next slide, which is slide number 13 on the issues of legal. Now, on the issues of legal, I think what is key here to mention is the fact that there is a need on our side, because we deploy in multiple areas and etc., but what is quite key is for us to be familiar with the expectations of international regulatory frameworks on the use of force. So we will be deploying in a number of areas, and in those areas that we deploy, there is quite a lot of things that are happening, i.e. cross-border movement of people, even in our own borders, good services. And therefore, it is important that we familiarize ourselves with this regulation. Climate change is one of the areas which today is actually the entire globe, if I may say so, is affected by climate change. And we have seen recently the involvement of the Department of Defense in trying to save lives, where lives were at stake with the recent operations that have just taken place. And then moving over to the area of technology, I think this is one of the threats that is dominating the international security agenda, and that is cyber threat. Now, in this regard, we will not be immune to cyber attacks. And therefore, as a defense force, we are going to endeavor to develop both offensive and defensive capabilities to be able to deal with it. However, what is key to note is the fact that, again,
it goes back to the resources that are available for us to do something in this area. Having said that, though, we are moving slowly, with a very slow pace, but we are moving and we are getting there because we are identifying the potentials in this area and trying to put up this capability within current resource allocation. But there's a need to fund this particular environment. In terms of technology research, despite the fact that the resources may not be that adequate, but we are going to try and make sure that we continue. And how are we doing this? We're making use of the national pool at times. Within the DOD, we do have, at the various levels within the DOD, and encourages research and development. Because that is how a soldier we will be able to come up with those capabilities that we will be requiring for war. And therefore, then, we still make use of the national pool of research capability that is available, i.e., as indicated on the slide, we've got the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. As the military chairperson, we deploy in areas where we are faced with a myriad of threats. And some of these threats would include your improvised explosive device. In fact, the defense review went to the point of saying that the strategic environment was unpredictable and was volatile, and you cannot be sure what is the next thing that is going to happen in the next day or in the next month. And therefore then, as a result of that, it is important that we make sure that our defense forces at all times are combat ready. But we are finding ourselves in this situation. We deploy in areas where we have soldiers that go to survive there for months, and therefore then it is important that they are properly equipped and they are able to survive in those particular areas. What we are also seeing today, wherein we are doing acquisition, we are finding the fact that there is quite a lot of weapon systems that are available, cash of the shelf and military of the shelf. What this means is therefore the fact that you are then going to have the acquisition process being shortened, because if somebody can go to the shelf and just buy one of the most sophisticated weapon systems to use it, then this is going to be the trend in the future. And then when it comes to matters of corporate governance, I think one of the issues that we are looking at is to complete our ethics policy within the Department of Defense. And statutorily, as it is expected from the DOD, is the DOD audit committee, as well as the DOD internal audit. Now, we do have the DOD audit committee, and it constantly reviews the effectiveness of internal DOD control systems and the internal audit functions and the DOD risk areas to be covered in the scope of internal and external audits. But there's one area which we are still endeavoring to fix, and that's the area of internal audit, and this is through full capacitation of the environment of the internal audit. Now, with regards to governance risk, just three things I want to mention there. We've got this in place, and we are doing this. We've got a strategic risk management committee, which we will have to continue to make sure that we can assess the risk of the department on a continuous basis. And we also have the accountability management committee and the DOD audit committee. We both of them will continue regular risk assessment and to ensure a culture of risk management within the department. The governance of IT, just one thing I would like to mention on that one, is the fact that we are moving towards an integrated defense enterprise system. And the reason for that is because we've got legacy ICT systems which we want to get rid of, so that when you are in one area or in one part of the system and you want to move over to see what's happening in personnel, you are able to transition between that. And when it comes, it will assist us, especially when it comes to matters of check making, i.e. your 30 days payment as it is. Expected by governance. On matters of compliance, I think the audit outcomes have always have been indicating and pointing us to the fact that within the human resource, financial, and procurement areas, these are the areas that we've got to monitor and to look at.
at least in order to mitigate the audit outcomes of that, and this will consider these areas as the areas of service delivery improvement areas. And with regards to corruption and fraud, I need to say that we have nodal points in this regard, and we are going to continue to make use of those nodal points. We've got a directorate which we have established, and that directorate is the one that deals with the issues of corruption. In other ways, detection should come from somewhere, but finally they are facing the fact that yes, indeed, this is corruption. And they've also established a hotline within the DOD, and that hotline is being used, and they go out and they do an assessment to check what is it, is this corruption or what is happening in this case, and allowing whistleblowers to make use of these lines, including but though the other thing which they do is to make sure that they create awareness, them being the nodal point in this regard. The court decisions affecting the DOD, honorable members, I think this is one area which we will have to continue to improve the effectiveness and interface with the state attorney. And this is to ensure timely compliance of within the DOD in this regard. We haven't had so problems that much in this area. However, one needs to state that within the DOD there is contingent liability, and it is a contingent liability. And with the time, gradually, this might be dealt with, but there is a contingent liability on matters of litigation. Then stakeholder relations management, I think we're trying to balance on this one, our stakeholders. But what is key that we want to bring out here is the fact that there has been consensus on defense by South Africans through representatives in parliament. Because then we have the defense review that has been approved by parliament. So as a result, there is consensus on the defense, and in the space of defense, we were given a clear decision to say that this is the option, it's approved, and that is the option that we have to go ahead and develop, of course, the defense. Though at this point in time, there is a of a challenge when it comes to resource allocation. Supply chain management, an area of audit interest, and we think that this area we are working towards also strengthening this area so that we can get rid of a number of things. For example, what we are doing now is to make sure that we're putting out a procurement policy, but the implementation of this procurement policy is pending the finalization of the procurement bill itself, so that then we can link up with it and then we can continue to implement it. But then it's going to also to be empowering the SMMEs, as is always contained in the State of the Nation address in this regard. So we are working on this policy, and that will assist us as well for local procurement and empowering of SMMEs. Now, honorable members, I'm on slide number 18. Just to say that the last, the last two, as indicated down there, have been approved have been introduced in Parliament. And this is the Defense Amendment Bill. Now, the Defense Amendment Bill was brought in for a number of reasons. And one of them was to effect the administrative discharge. And the second, and other areas, but just to mention, as well, the inclusion of the Chief of Staff as a member of the military command, being a senior officer in the department. We also have the hydrographic bill. Now, the hydrographic bill in itself is quite key at sea, wherein it will assist in terms of safety of navigation, navigational mapping and charting. As we all know, that I think our waters, be they in the exclusive economic zone, but this is one that is very busy, because we are at least a point where the vessels will pass from both the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. Then the first one is indicated, the military discipline bill. This one is yet to be introduced to Parliament, and this we believe is going to happen very soon.
If I may talk to the defense policy, just to give the details of what this defense policy is all about. As I indicated earlier on, it has been approved by the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. And we have then thereafter went and drafted one of the immediate requirements, which was the plan to arrest the decline. And when we have drafted that plan, we made it into 5-5 packages. Now, the first two packages we felt that we can implement within current resource allocation, but the last three needed to be resourced for them to be implemented. And as things stand, the defense review has not been resourced. Now, therefore then, once it has not been resourced, what are the implications? When the defense review itself was being written, it was very clear to say that defense capabilities are in a state of decline. So that means, given the fact that it has been approved in 2015 and where we are today, which is in 2019, and there has not been an intervention into these defense capabilities, what it therefore means is that the decline has not been arrested as things stand. So this is an area of concern from the side of the defense force. I think the next slide, on slide number 22, what we were doing there was to indicate exactly to honorable members what would be the cost implication of the work package 3, 4, and 5, and it is that as indicated in that particular slide. Performance delivery environment on slide number 21, as we indicated, we are guided nationally, all state departments, in order to build our APPs. We are directed by the master document which is available of government, and that is the NDP 2030. We take a cue from that. And all what we are, which is encompassed, should lead us to be finding ourselves within the mandate paper of government, that is, which is at least to play a key role in resource allocation. So we are also making use of this instrument of government. We have the constitution that defines the defense mandate, but we also make sure that in terms of what we are doing, talks to government expectations. Now moving forward, therefore, just to unpack a bit on the NDP. Now all these, which are on slide number 22, are as for the fifth administration, but we were contributing to this. And in terms of the youth, I've already spoken, the interns, the MSDS, I've spoken the National Youth Service, and environmental sustainability, an issue which we indicated how we are participating, disaster aid and disaster relief. And with regard to South Africa in the region and in the continent, we are participating in a number of ways. We've got maritime security, which we are doing anti-piracy operations in the Mozambique channel. We're also doing research and development, ensuring safer community by our presence in the border area, and also building a capable and developmental state, just by being a defense force. That without this security that is needed, how then would development be ensured? And as well, again, I think one of the things that we are doing is to fight corruption, as I indicated earlier on in the previous slide. And continuing on slide number 23, I think that with regards to the MTSF, just the two where we are participating. As indicated in the slide, that the blue is where we participate indirectly, but the red is the way we are participating, and that is all people in South Africa are interested, and the last one being creating a better South Africa, a better Africa, and a better world. We are participating on those, and just to unpack them a bit, just to indicate clearly, the outcome three, the sub-outcome, we participate in sub-outcome three, which is in border safeguarding. So 15 sub-units would have liked to upscale to 22 units. We are doing maritime patrols per year, which is about 4 of them. And then we meet as well on sub-outcome 4, that is securing the cyberspace. Sub-outcome 5 as well, like I indicated in the previous slide, we are participating on that with regards to corruption, to fight corruption in the public sector.
And then sub-outcome 3, ensuring political cohesion, this talks to outcome 11. We are also participating in this, in the main, through peace missions and things, and we have made pledges to, for example, the SADC standby force, and also we are still part of the African capacity for immediate response to crisis, which has not been closed down. And that is, South Africa was part of initiating that capability which has been put in place. And suffice to say here that I think at this point in time, we have the regional standby force arrangement. And the ASRIC, which is the African capacity for immediate response to crisis, was put in place as an interim mechanism while we are getting in place the African standby force. In other words, we need to say what is available with the African standby force and where it is, so that we can all be certain that we do have the African standby force really that is in place. And the rest of the slide, what is showing in the map, is our involvement in these missions with Operation Mistral, and as well as our involvement with Operation Copa in the Mozambique channel. I think, therefore, moving on to the next slide, it is just to point out again that the 9-point plan, wherein we are actively participating in the 9-point plan of government, is talking about Operation Takita, that has a few initiatives, some of those initiatives that are being led by the Defense Force, and in this case, that is the South African Navy. So we are participating in Operation Pakistan. We also have got Kuvatala. And Kuvatala, this is the collaboration with other departments and provincial governments to enable the development of vibrant, equitable, sustainable rural communities, contribution towards the food security in the RSA. What we are doing on this one, honorable members, is that we have initiated a project by the reserve force within the defense force to say that let us assist communities, let us get the reserve force involved to be able to make the community to be sustainable in the agricultural environment. And we started this project in the Northwest, and the full presentation about this initiative is available. It has been presented many a times in the economic class, and it was welcomed. So this project has been started, and it is moving on. It is in the Northwest. It's going to be moving, being rolled out, if I may use the word, throughout other provinces, mainly the reserve force being utilized and integrating the communities in the rural areas in South Africa. The first are the action plan. I think here the point that one needs to make is to say that we are participating in this. I want to single out the most prominent one, which always comes out in the State of the Nation address, and which the director generals within the FOSAT, they are also seized with, and that is the payment within 30 days. I need to indicate here that when we table our annual report, it's going to be very clear and visible of the fact that there is an improvement in this regard. I think at this point where we are sitting, we are in the region of about 81% compliance. The biggest challenge being, of course, where we talk about our ITC systems in order for us to be able to monitor what is happening and track all these invoices by means of an IT system. The mandate paper I've already spoken about. I think this particular slide I may skip, Chairperson, allowing me in the interest as well of time. We have noted the issues here that were addressed in the State of the Nation address. And all of these issues, Chairperson, which we have listed here, it is our intention, therefore, that we are going to be participating in them. When we talk about, for instance, the need to stepping up the fight against corruption and state capture, this is an area which we have spoken about. This came from the State of the Nation address, as addressed by the President addressing the nation. So I wouldn't want to go through that. A number of these things I have covered. And if I may move over then to the next slide, and to indicate that with regards to the African Union Agenda 2063, we again participating in this through our involvement in peace missions. And therefore, when it comes to the SADC environment, we are working together with our SADC partners, and we will continue to do so through exercises and by making pledges which we have already pledged, by the way. And also, as I indicated, compliance with current orders, external commitment, which we are working together with our SADC partners to ensure peace, of course, in the SADC region. We have had ministerial priorities. I need to indicate on these priorities that these were the ministerial priorities for the sixth administration. Now, as we are moving towards the sixth administration, the minister has already indicated to us what her priorities are moving forward to the sixth administration. And therefore, then, in our tabling of our 2021 APP, we will then have included the new ministerial priorities as she has guided the department on that. The Secretary for Defense, they were meant to support the Minister of Defense priorities then, but all of these priorities, and including these ones of the Chief of the Defense Force, on slide number 34, they are all still included in this particular APP. Moving ahead, and this is the organization of the Department of Defense. Right on top there, we've got the Minister of Defense and Military Veterans with the Deputy Minister of Defense and Military Veterans. And then, as we indicated, we've got two areas. Before the two areas, we've got public entities and organs of state. And here we're talking AMCO, we're talking cartel control, we're talking Defense Force Service Commission, the military ombud, and then the South African National Defense Force, with all the components that they have on the right of the table, as well as the Secretary for Defense, with all the staff components that are available, indicated on the right side of the table. Now, this is the budget structure of the Department of Defense. We have not changed our budget structure. We have retained the 8 programs, and these are the 8 programs which we have included in our annual performance plan. And with those programs, this is how the resource allocation has been distributed. What is indicated in red is budget cut. But if we look at 21-22, there is a heavy budget cut there on defense, and that is 5 billion that has been indicated. And we need to indicate as well the fact that even though it looks like it's 183 for the current financial year, we are going to show a picture that shows the historical budget recast of the Department of Defense today. But the 5 billion, Chairperson, is quite a heavy cut. We have suffered a few billions of rands prior to this, and we have indicated to the Portfolio Committee. We have indicated to the Joint Standing Committee on Defense as well on the cuts that are being incurred by the Department of Defense. This is by way of comparison. Now, if we look at 2018 and 2019 on slide number 38, when comparing the two, the heavy casualties in terms of budget for 2019 will be your maritime defense program, will be your air defense program, and will be your landward defense program. And these are the work goals within the Department of Defense. Now, this is a picture that shows how then the budget was reduced. And I would request honorable members that we look at 21-22, because that is 5 billion out of the Department of Defense for 21-22. And already, as things stand, now what is happening is once that budget has been cut, it's got a lot of implications to defense. Huge implications, which I think maybe if time allowing and we can make this to the Joint Standing Committee on Defense, that would be sufficient. Now, this is the historical budget cut that I spoke about. If we look at it right up until 2020, we've got about 25 billion. And this has got a major implications. It has got major implications when it comes to the output of the Department of Defense. That today, in 2020, you would have suffered at least the 25 billion of the budget cut. Now, this particular slide is an illustration of what should have been. I'm on slide number 41, and it's of what should have been the defense allocation. The defense review has clearly indicated that we are not far from what the defense review has predicted. And the DOD's full allocation should have been in the region of about 8 billion, and therefore then what we have is 50 billion, and therefore the shortfall goes up to the region of about 30 billion. Now, honorable members, there are implications on this reduced budget cut for the Department of Defense. The first one here is the impact on military operations, and it impacts on sustainment, supporting military operations themselves. It will also impact, I think, on training. Now, here is an issue about training. This is an environment which we are too concerned about. Because when you are allocated the budget, even if you give so much money to training, but your support structures do not have that money, you've got a problem because that training you cannot execute. For example, if you give money for training, but you don't have money to provide for ration for the soldiers that are in the field, busy either with deployment or busy with training, you would have to balance it. So therefore, training will always be affected in whichever way that we go. But the major implications of this is, as listed on the slide, honorable members, I think on these ones, this is an area which is a sore point, if I may put it that way, for the Department of Defense. And then moving over then to slide number 43, where we indicate the compensation of employees. Honorable members, one thing that one would like to point out on slide number 43 is the fact that where we have indicated projected over expenditure on ceiling, in our view as the military, this is an accounting terminology that we are using over here. What is happening is the 2.9 billion and the 3 billion in 2021, as well as the 3.4 billion in 2021-22, this is a shortfall. It is a shortfall in the sense that this money was cut away from the Department of Defense. and so this is it's a pending matter, and if I may just say a bit on this particular matter. In the previous financial year, we had the same situation. And there was a discussion with National Treasury in this regard. There was discussion with DPSA in this regard. That if we don't put, if you look at 2.9 billion and say, how many of the soldiers are you not going to pay their salary? 2.9 billion. So that would mean you've got a lot of soldiers that you're not going to pay the salary. If this money is not available, are we then implying the fact that we need to get rid of this number of soldiers and put them in the streets? I don't think so. I don't think so, because then the implications will be dire in this regard. And it's not a situation that all of us would want to find ourselves in. So 2.9 billion is quite a big number for us to look at. And it's an area that would need immediate attention as well. Then, honorable members, I think this slide, if I may say, Chairperson, I've covered it in the sense that we've spoken about the 2.9 billion and the three, and the outer years, the shortfall within the compensation of employees. The emphasis, however, is to say that as the Department of Defense, members would say, how big is this defense force? The defense force is around 75,000 in strength. This is inclusive of the civilian component of the Department of Defense. There is a slide that shows the recent exact figure, I think it's 74,000 in that region. But it is important for us to say, when people look at the number and then they conclude to say the defense force is too big, let's bear in mind we've got the Army Air Force Navy, we've got support components in that environment, we've got the civilian component, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, going down, it's an area that we need to look at, because as the defense force, we feel that this is the threshold within which we cannot move down, but we need to stick in that round figure of 75,000. Now, these are the expenditure estimates. I have indicated the challenges with the compensation of employees on slide number 45.
And we have indicated the need to arrest the decline in defense capabilities. We have indicated the fact that we are going to be continuing to participate in peace support operations. And we have resourced, joint operations have been resourced as far as to be able to sustain the operations abroad. We're going to be continuing with border safeguarding and ensuring the territorial integrity of the Republic of South Africa. We are bordering in the region of about 6 countries in this regard. And in this case, we are including as well maritime operations to execute the maritime security strategy. And support to the people, this one, honorable members, currently, honorable members will know, we will support the people of South Africa as and when we are ordered to do so as the defense force. And we, there is currently a project that's going on, Deputy Leval and the defense forces is participating in that. We've participated in the Northwest. Recently, we were deployed to save lives in the neighborhood, and there is quite a number of things that we are doing to support the people of South Africa. And this is where the defense force will endeavor to ensure that we support the people of South Africa in terms when there is such a need for the defense force to do so. If I may move over, honorable members, to slide number 49 and talk about the DOD selected performance indicators, I just need to indicate the fact that we have maintained those performance indicators indicated in slide number 49. That's on with regards to the attachés that we've deployed abroad, and with regards to the reserve force mandate utilization. And also, we are indicating the fact that we will comply with the SADC standby force 100%, execute our external missions 100%, and internal missions 100%. The 100% target is because when we are ordered to go and do so, we will go and do so as the Department of Defense. So a request is given to say that the defense force must be deployed in that particular area. We will go and deploy in that particular area. I am now on slide number 51, honorable members, and in this particular slide, it is to indicate the number of members subsidies, where I've indicated the fact that we want to scale up in this regard. And we just don't want to scale up just on the number of subsidies. We have written what is called the sensor strategy. We've written what is called the border safeguarding strategy. Wherein what we want is force multiplier that are informed by these strategies which we have put in place. So that it is not just boots on the ground, because we have got 4,471 plus minus land borders. That is the length of our borderline, and that is true. And just by putting boots on the ground may not completely seal our borders, but we need force multiplier, i.e. sensors, to be able to do this. But notably, we have reduced on that particular slide number 41, and this is given budgetary constraints. If we look at the number of flying hours there, we have reduced it to 17,200, when we should have had 25,000, and we have reduced as well the number of sea hours. The number of sea hours, the Navy would have liked to have 12,000, because this is critical for them to always exercise and keep their personnel and their equipment at the readiness level which they would require. And honorable members, there's something here which probably one can think. The training of the defense. It's one area which we have not indicated yet, because this is a selected text area, but that's an area that I think with the Joint Standing Committee on Defense at the time when we are called, we will need to indicate this kind of matter. And therefore linked to other plans, honorable members, this has got to do with the maintenance and repair of the DOT facilities. The state of the DOT facilities, honorable members, is not that good. And we have taken an initiative to say that let us come up with a West regiment. This West regiment is a capability that is within the Department of Defense for us to be able to maintain the facilities of the DOT as and when
who would want to do that. Now, this is the resources that have been put in this regard to be able to do this, to ensure that we can arrest the decline. We were using the Department of Public Works, and there has been an agreement, as we all know, honorable members, that the public works has got the responsibility to look after streets and facilities. And because of the challenges within public works, we then initiated the fact that we need to build our own in-house capability. We have built that, and they still need to be capacitated further. And work, they are currently doing some work in terms of maintenance and repair of our facilities. Entities that are reporting to the minister, this is just to indicate, I'm sure if here they will indicate what they have, but 1.4 billion is the budget allocation. And Castle Control, as we know, honorable members, they are self-sustaining at this point in time. The utilization of consultants. I need to move over with the utilization of consultants, and just to indicate to honorable members on slide number 56 to say that for whatever the consultants that are being used in the various fields that they are being utilized for, that is the figure which we have, and that's about 22.3 million rand. That's in the utilization of the consultants as to what has been initiated in the particular slide. Now, with regards to the enterprise risk, the risk talks to the state of the Department of Defense. We have this enterprise risk. We have presented the risk many a time, and I need to indicate the fact that they have not changed, except that we have built in one or two risks, which, of course, an opportunity given to the Joint Standing Committee on Defense, we can then communicate on those risks. But it's very clear, the first one is the last point that I talked about, deteriorating DOD facilities, and the non-integration of our ICT systems, which is an area that within the department we are fixing this particular problem. And therefore the prevalence in fraud, I think this one is a matter of putting out measures in place. But to get rid of it, to say that remove it from the risk register, will be too early to do so. We need to make sure that we keep on putting the mechanisms just to curtail fraud and corruption within the DOD. High prevalence of litigation, I indicated that we do have a contingent liability within the Department of Defense. And forfeited rights on DOD property, this is one of the things, I think, which we will be working on it. We are also, in this regard, concerned about recovering technology in the Department of Defense, an area which we don't want to lose at all. And that talks to the industry's capacity to supply and support to the Department of Defense. And if I may just move over then, honorable members, to the concluding slide. And the concluding slide is one that indicates the fact that as and when we have got the defense force that is deployed in various missions, there is value in doing so. And therefore, then, they need to capacitate the Department of Defense. Chairperson, that is the ECT of the Department of Defense, without going down into each and every performance indicator and the target which we have set. Of course, which are constrained. And that being said, therefore, Chairperson, I want to hand back to the Chief of Staff, General.
Thank you very much, General Ramaswamy. Honorable Chair, Honorable Deputy Minister, and honorable members, we are now ready to interact with you by way of questions and answers. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the presentation. It was comprehensive indeed, very detailed, and covered a lot of issues. You also touched on the defense review. We have decided as a committee that the fiscal report that we need to take a briefing on it. So the session set aside to go through it because it deals with the whole issue of arresting decline in the Southern Defense Force. And so what we are presenting is that the budget doesn't even go nearer towards starting to arrest the decline. That's the essence of your presentation. With that as it may, I'm now looking at members. Mr. Marais, you are the first person. Mr. Mate, you are second. And Mulke, you are third. And Matthias, you are fourth. And then I'll come back to Bachelet.
Thank you very much, Chair. In the beginning, I must admit, it sounds like a very promising picture. Knowing very well from my experience that it's not like that, and then you end it off by saying it's not as good as you made it in the beginning, which is more realistic. Chair, the one thing that I would have liked us to see, and that linked to your observation that we are not even close to what we need to spend or execute, and that is the guidelines by the National Treasury and Defence Review on the human resource, operations, and equipment, the 40-30-30. That we know that we are now, I mean, as you quite rightfully said, we are now at 59 on HR, and I mean, a simple equation is if you spend about 30 on operations, it means there's only 10 available for equipment, and that means maintenance and all that, and that means that we are on a downward slope enormously fast. And also with regards to all five milestones, to just indicate to these new members what is the practical implications of all five milestones and where we are at the moment. But that as it may be, Chairperson, I am going to cover a number of issues that I would very much, that is of a concern to me, and I really carry this at the interest of the Defence Force at heart. The one thing that you have indicated here, and that's the possibility of support or deployment of the Defence Force in cases of unrest. And once again see there's a lot of talk about that many times in the urban areas. Now, I know what was the response last year, but I think it's important to get the feedback of what is the status quo with regards to the possibility and the desirability of deployment of soldiers in urban areas. Are they being trained to do that? Do we have specialized units? We know that apparently there's 15 units deployed to the land borders. And we know that 15 is on the border, 15 in training, and 15 at home. And in terms of what we have got in the DRC, my knowledge is that we haven't got enough medically fit soldiers to be deployed into urban areas. So please give us an indication where we stand in terms of medical classification of those that can possibly be deployed into urban areas, because that is a huge risk if we send in soldiers that is not medically fit to otherwise provide service in other areas. The second one is the whole thing about the rejuvenation of the Defence Force. In the past, I know that we were given the average age of an infantry soldier of 32 years, where do we stand at the moment? The average age of all the HR component in the, of the DOD was about 42, and I know that the average age of senior ranks officers was about well over 50 years of age. Where do we stand there? And because, I mean, if rejuvenation is a high priority, then we need to know where we stand and how we can impact on that. A concern of mine is with regard to rejuvenation. I understand that there was a directive being given to not hand out camouflage uniforms because of the non-availability of that,